Welcome to the Rooted in Change podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jan, and you're listening to the Rooted in Change podcast. Today, I'm talking to Christian, the CEO of Efenco. Efenco's story goes back to the far unknowns of the universe, studying distant galaxies and the tiniest particles. In easy terms, the company delivers a technology to increase fuel combustion efficiency, thereby reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Christian will explain how all of this works in just a second. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you, Jan. Happy to be here.
And I'm very happy to have you. Let's start with my first question to you. Could you share a bit about your personal background?
Sure. Well, starting from, I think in that context, relevant part is my early lessons in engineering. In particular, it was electricity. I have a degree in low current systems development, but that journey kind of ended. It wasn't so interesting for me, and then I entered into economics study and finished 2 universities in economics. But funny enough, this engineering has been always part of my journey. So it appeared to be a really important part, having understanding of the systems and maybe tiniest root causes of bigger systems. So I think this is one important cornerstone of my story. And I after the university, I kind of found myself in entrepreneurship, building a ticketing company in Estonia. So it was early 2000s when, after the re-independence of Estonia, we had a big concert organizer with Tina Turner concert, and I found myself as a managing director of the company, and we started with like paper tickets, and during next 6 years I was responsible of building a ticketing system, which was really innovative at that time. So the another kind of cornerstone of entrepreneurship and developing business and also software. And after that, I found myself in a consultancy helping Estonian Innovation Agency to support innovative companies to build green tech or whatever technologies, consulting startups, handing out funds for them. And I think this connects the dots what I do today, already 8 years in Efenco.
Right. And I mentioned, and you also touched upon it, the tiniest particles. So let's dive into this. In preparing for today's conversation, I read about plasma. So what is Efenco's story and what is it that you do?
All right, that's going to be deep dive.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. I mean, if we really start from deep dive, then it is part of the story, actually, how Efenco, actually the name Efenco comes from efficient energy conversion, which in every transaction in nowadays world, we convert energy from one form to another. And when we really start to dig in what happens in those turning points, in those conversions, then we have to acknowledge that, for example, the major energy is converted from, let's say, some molecules to usable work energy. And the story starts from that my co-founders, scientists, mainly one who was author of the idea, was, let's say, self deducting in astrophysics, and he like 20, 30 years studied astrophysics and built his own models and found some phenomenons, mathematical phenomenons in astrophysical level. And as he had history in subatomic levels as well, he worked in a nuclear enrichment factory in Soviet time in Estonia.
Right.
So he starts to connect some dots, and he saw that if we look into the, let's say, in the atom, in the, let's say, tiniest particle from a bit another angle of let's say how the science is looking today, and connecting the dots, what he noticed in macro level in astrophysics, he had a hypothesis that if we can change the path of the reaction, let's say if we take combustion for example, then we can extract more energy out of the same molecule or fuel. And that was the beginning of the story. And maybe it's relevant to mention here, if we are digging diving in, that just to have mindset, what is the efficiency of conversion?
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful to know in as a benchmark.
Exactly. Then let's recall our physics studies in universities. Einstein has claimed that energy is mass multiplied with the speed of light, and this is a huge number. If we
Yeah.
just have some kind of benchmark, then one glass of water, 200 milligrams, is actually, if we multiply this 200 milligrams with speed of light, this accounts for 250,000 household yearly energy needs. So one glass of water supposed to hold that much of energy. And now, if we compare it, this energy efficiency with what how we convert energy from, for example, whatever, is it liquid or gaseous fuel? Let's say we burn natural gas or biogas, doesn't matter actually. Then the efficiency compared to this benchmark, this total full potential energy, is 0.8 zeros and 1% out of the total. So this gives the kind of estimate. And yes, there we are working, and we see that there is possibilities to change the conversion reaction in these processes.
Right, and obviously that's going to be quite a game changer in terms of, well, improving that efficiency and thereby lowering the demand for fuel.
Absolutely. I mean, if we like, I mean, this one thing what I see, what is a bit maybe problematic in current mainstream mindset, that we say that we have to fade away or get rid of fossils, but if we really, without any prejudice or just clearly think, the question is not fossils. The question is how smartly we can convert energy with less pollution or less emissions. And if we need much less fuel to get the same amount of energy, then this definitely adds a lot to environmental and energy domain, that it's no-brainer in that case.
And especially because traditional fuels, at least from the sort of the conventional mindset, are quite energy dense and hold that energy density that we're looking for. And you know, all our systems run on fossil fuels more or less. So just changing the way that system operates and making it a ton more efficient will obviously be quite a game changer, and then also decrease the stress on the overall system to make that transition as fast as possible, because obviously it's not feasible to transition to a net zero economy right away from the very system that we have. That's going to take some time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to kind of mark 2 points here. That one is what we see as our vision is that definitely we transition to, I mean, hydrogen is, from our perspective, has huge perspective also from deep fundamental physics point of view. But the cleanest conversion is one of the key element, and the other aspect, the question is how we switch over, not what is good, what is bad, but what is the best way to switch over. And what you just mentioned, that in current let's say green transition thinking, I see that the problematic thing is that this switchover cost, not like monetary cost, but environmental and material cost, is often forgotten. I mean, to change the whole infrastructure in such a short time demands a lot of energy to produce all those wind power and solar and I mean, as we, our first application is industrial heat. I just came from Paris in the International Energy Agency forum. It's so clear that, like, technology-wise, it's kind of possible. There are challenges still, but the electricity, like green electricity amount that industry needs is so huge, plus the grid, there is no grid that can support that kind of massive change. So if we imagine to change the whole infrastructure from the production, the grid, the industry furnaces, it all needs materials, energy, and this is so huge. So the question is, what is the overbalance when we, when the alternative is to have healthy mix? I see that the question is always a healthy mix, not one or the other, like competing, but this, to see a holistic healthy mix.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe just before we also talk maybe a bit about how that energy forum was, and maybe sort of how the overall perspective there was, also from a European and maybe global perspective. If you had to explain your tech to someone who hasn't studied physics, how would you explain what happens and why does it work and why does it lower the fuel consumption needs? Why is it more efficient?
All right, I'll try to be as general as possible. It's often so.
It's a challenge, huh?
challenge always challenge. So. Anyway, if I start from how it works technically, then it works like that. That what we have is we call them chips, HERC chips, high energy rate ceramics is the abbreviation of HERC, and those are, let's say, standalone units. There are no wires. They will be placed into the, let's say, combustion chamber of, let's imagine some big gas-fired boiler or whatever the combustion unit is. So they are in the walls of the combustion, and what they start to do, they convert waste heat of the process. In that context, again, the combustion. They take this heat and they convert this heat into the radiation. We have so-called soft X-ray radiation that those chips are emitting. And we can call our technology also photon generator. So it generates photons out of the waste heat of the reaction. And those photons flying into the combustion reaction start to ionize, if we explain a bit. Technically, the term is plasma-assisted combustion, and plasma is ionized gas. So we excite those molecules, in some terms, in the higher energy states. This radiation will change their, let's say, behavior, and this allows to interact with, let's say, deepest particles of the atom. To be very precise, we should explain what is the atom and how is the nucleus there is reacting in this. I guess this is not the topic of today. What we have, just to be clear, so those chips are in the reactions. There are a number of those chips. They are small, let's say, 2 to 3 centimeters. At the end of the process, we have right now prototypes that delivering 20% extra energy. So this is the beginning of where we are. We are still in lab, but we have repeatedly validated the effect. We are in development to sustain this effect and material technology chances.
Right, and let me rephrase that last part so we're completely sure that at least I got this right. So,
okay.
By sort of emitting that extra energy, the plasma, that thereby decreases the need for more / new fuel. Is that correct? Because you sort of, as you described it, you excite the atoms and the molecules, the particles, and thereby you decrease the need for more fuel to keep the engine going. Did I describe that correctly in layman terms?
Yes, you got it right. Maybe if I rephrase it again, maybe it helps to clarify the situation. So the use case would be like that. That another angle. That yes, this radiation that our technology is emitting, creating plasma-assisted combustion. Like naturally, the temperature will be higher, so the heat conversion to the system, that is the principle of the boiler, will be higher. But we will do is to reduce the gas supply. So at the end of the equilibrium will be that the temperature is the same, but the gas supply is less, and heat is the same what is produced.
Great, got it. And you just said that you were at lab stage now. So maybe also going back to the journey that you described at the beginning of our interview, how far have you come and what are your next steps?
We are, just how far have we come? I have to remind that we have developed 8 years now. Coming from the lab, small scale proof of principles and small scale prototypes, our major breakthrough was, let's say, already 2 years ago, a bit less than 2 years ago, when we were validating the scalability in those technologies. Always the question is it scalable? So we had this half megawatt industrial boiler installed with the technology, and we validated the effect is there in the, let's say, meaningful scale as well. And after that, we started to develop product. I mean, that was proof of scalability with a lot of compromises we did for the product, so we can really validate. And now, 1.5 year, we have built and developed and reiterating the technology to have durability there. And at the moment, we are still in process to have the right engineering, right materials. I mean, maybe if we dig in into the our kitchen a bit, what are our challenges? You understand that the combustion environment is quite harsh.
Yes.
You don't want to be there.
No.
But we have to convince those small chips that they should be there a long time.
Right. Yeah.
And this temperature, what we exploit inside those chips is so-called vacuum nanoelectronics, which is, maybe I don't know how many listeners are in engineering, but the core principle is actually we use pyroelectric crystals that convert heat into electricity, electrons.
Right.
And, these electrons will be converted to the radiation, and that must be inside vacuum. So inside the chips
Right.
is a vacuum, high, like deep vacuum. So those are our engineering and material technology challenges we work with at the moment.
I can imagine them.
Quite challenging, I can assure.
Yeah, it's interesting that you don't just have, you know, the harsh conditions to deal with, but then, and this is also why I asked before, but ultimately also a highly complex tech with multiple layers of, you know, of hurdles in the way, in order to make this work. And just as you mentioned this before, quickly, you said that the first application is waste heat, right? So did I get that right?
I mean, I have to clarify this waste heat concept. The just
Yes.
to be clear, it can be in another context.
Yes, many people have different definitions of what waste heat can be.
Maybe I once rephrased the principle of how we approach the main concept of the technology is we reuse the heat of the reaction to make it more efficient. So
Yes.
If we jump
Same
once,
temperature, less fuel.
yes, and waste heat in that sense that every combustion has some heat losses. So we
Yep.
the what we use for ignite or fuel our technology is normally wasted anyway. So that's why in that context it's waste heat.
Yes.
So yes, this is the waste heat thing.
But what we're saying is basically any combustion engine could run with your tech, or are there specific industries that work better for you compared to others?
Yeah, if you ask about application areas, then coming back to this principle, reusing the heat of the reaction into the more efficient reaction or conversion, we can say, then the application areas actually is wider than combustion. If we stick into the combustion, which is at the moment our, let's say, first market entry domain, then our focus today is industrial combustion applications, and there are many reasons for that. One reason is that the simplest combustion application is boiler. There is a huge flame, huge like combustion chamber. There is not much dust, no other obstacles. So this is where we enter to the market. Also working with we have validated with hydrogen combustion as well, and methane, and of course biogas is the gaseous fuel combustion is in industrial level is our first focus. But in principle, application areas are as wide as you can imagine in combustion domain. Yes, internal combustion engine, in principle, yes, but the environment is totally different. You know, there is an explosion, and what happens, it's a bit different. And also, if you think about different fuels, as I said, focus is gaseous fuel, because it's the cleanest environment, but we have also liquid and solid fuels. In principle, all are applicable, but the environments are much more challenging. So
Right.
for us, the question is, where to put our first efforts. And most probably, well, it makes so much sense to move all on those domains later on. But I need to just point out that the technology application areas is not only combustion. So coming back to the main principle, reusing the heat of the reaction, we are already working, prototyping a bit in electrolyzers as well. So it's called plasma assisted electrolysis, and we have got already, let's say, not stable yet, but effects that we can really make difference in producing hydrogen as well. And let's say third domain is reducing exhaust gases. So again, reactions are different, but the same radiation, if we apply it in the exhaust pipes, then it breaks down the, let's say, more dangerous exhaust particles to less. So the application areas are a huge list of so we our challenge is to keep the focus.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Really exciting to hear also about the other applications. That obviously opens a whole other field and whole other domains, and I guess it makes a whole lot of sense to start with the
sure.
cleanest fuels and then scale to the more challenging ones, rather than doing it the opposite way around. And as you just mentioned, the sort of how far you've come, you know, you said you've been developing for 8 years. What have been some of the challenges that you had to overcome on this journey? What helped you to overcome these? And what was sort of what's been the most remarkable so far about these past 8 years for you?
Yeah, I would skip right now the technological part. Just one of our finding, what I truly believe. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had a speech in a deep tech startup event here in Estonia about development process and how we definitely are deep tech company.
Yeah, I think I can vouch for that, given sort of how far we've gone into, you know, Albert Einstein and the fundamentals of physics today. I would say so, yes.
Okay, the deep dive is going to be very deep, so the air will be finished soon. Anyway, what I think, I believe so that the essence or the challenge in actually it doesn't matter is it deep tech or not deep tech, it's human interaction, collaboration, how we as a team are able to communicate, listen to each other. This defines the speed of development, whatever domain. It's kind of that was my main message in this speech as well, that being in, I mean, if we talk about innovation, then innovation is not something that you just think and you now do innovation and you think differently. And if we imagine our situation where those, let's say, scientific domains, engineering domains, for example, material science, fundamental physics, plasma physics, they're all different aspects to the same kind of thing what we're working, adding on top another layer, that, like different personalities with different mindsets, different beliefs, maybe. So the challenge is really to think of the same thing so that everybody is listened, and not because it's nice to listen, but to really see that there is a new perspective. So to listen those perspectives, to be precise on that, not to judge based on one or the other ego, whatever, those, let's say, human aspects become really, really important. So if you ask what is, from my perspective at least, the main kind of enabler or challenge in development, making whatever innovation is, we can call it collaboration or like self-awareness as well, that we can really see different perspectives, not to try with the ones what we already have and reiterate the same thing. So it is challenging, and I see that we have made many steps towards. I mean, the beginning of the Fenko story was also, and the first claim was so out of the my other co-founder who had this approach or perspective or hypothesis that was so much out of the possibilities that I could imagine. But I in that moment, I had my personal kind of story that I practiced listening without the judgments. So I just listen without saying that it's wrong, right, calculating some answers. And the deepness, how well, whatever the claim was, how he was able to explain, opened new possibilities. And we decided that this must be tested, and so far it's quite good results, I would say.
How easy would you say is it to tell your story to the people that need to understand it and get it? So I'm thinking sort of investors, but also potential customers. Is it something that they're like mind blown, like, oh my God, this is so crazy because we started this interview with the universe and the tiniest particles, and have been talking quite a bit about this, going down the deep tech route. Has that been easy for you, or has that been rather challenging? Because from our experience and my experience, sometimes it can be, you're so ingrained in your technologies and you know so much about the fundamentals behind it and the way it works, but that it's sometimes hard to translate that into layman terms and make sure that also the outside public gets it, especially potentially because sometimes your buyers might know the principles but don't really get the effect right away. So maybe you can shine a bit of light of how this journey has been going for you.
Yes, you touched really, really important point. Sure, it's challenging, and it's challenging. This bias thing is so strong that I mean, from what angle to open this? I can share actually. Sometimes, wow, okay, this the same what I referred this Paris event in reception. I noticed that spoke with number of people, and I see that with the people who don't have let's say scientific background, they don't kind of already have they haven't defined how things supposed to be. They will be very excited, which is kind of logical as well, obvious that you don't know what is possible or what is impossible, then you can allow yourself to think this perspective. Is it true or not true? But you start to think and you can start to see possibility. And on the other hand, there are experience when I meet with let's say some people who have already developed the understanding how things supposed to be, then this is, and now of course there are different people, but the self-awareness that if you don't allow yourself to think differently, then you will be blocked, and this discussion you can't convince another people who has fixed this perspective. So this has been always challenged. The whole journey has been let's say fine-tuning this conversation, and well, I have taken this route that I don't have to convince. I just propose perspective. I don't push that this is the right. I just open the possibility and can explain how we know that this possibility, what is facts there, and we are also asking what is true. Not always that what's true. It doesn't matter. Do I believe or not what's true? That's what matters.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective because I think that's the really scientific answer. You know, there's one truth, and you're looking for that. Whereas obviously, if you, and that maybe brings us back to the event in Paris, if you interact with policymakers and you know, even the wider public, I would say that those lines of truth, they blur, because out of a sudden that scientific truth doesn't hold up as much anymore, because it becomes a matter of debate and opinion. So I'm just wondering, since you know, I guess just had that perspective, do you agree with that? That, you know, in a wider forum, these concepts of truth and, well, science is harder to convey, or do politicians and other people that you talk to also get that?
Let me rephrase to be clearer if I got your question. So in you ask whether this searching for truth will be blurred in let's say high level political discussion. The kind of truth is already defined.
Yeah, let me give another example. So, for example, we all know that we need to combat climate change, right? And the easiest thing would be to, well, draw down our emissions as fast as possible. And thereby, I guess we have a number of challenges from a science point of view. I think often it's quite clear what needs to be done. For example, we need to invest heavily in renewables, and then we would have to invest into more grid solutions, and so on and so on and so on. So I think there is the truth, in a sense that there is one or more logical approaches to tackle that problem. But when those technologies, because ultimately this is what it is, right? If investing in solar and wind, we're talking about technologies. But when they enter into the public domain, it's not the science and the technology anymore. They become sort of a less tangible good. For example, in Germany, there was just the case where it's pretty clear that in order to run the economy in a part of Bavaria, they need to invest in renewables, because they're lacking that, and otherwise it won't be able to they won't be able to sustain economic production there anymore. And they had different proposals on the table, but they voted down all of them. So out of a sudden, because they don't like wind power and they didn't like geothermal, and now they're left with nothing, and all these technologies have been politicized. So sort of this is the a remark, I guess, not so much a question, but rather a remark, that technologies in the public domain, especially when you're then talking to, yeah, politicians, policymakers, and so on, it loses that appeal of right and wrong, and the lines become more blurry.
Absolutely, I agree with this remark, and maybe if I build on top of that, I think it's the same thing from another perspective. What I see is kind of as your name of your podcast, Rooted in Change. I think the question is, we often jump between root cause and already much higher level results of something, and this and sometimes we kind of fix some solution which is like technology, and we don't measure result. This example is actually for me, I'm unhappy for that. I mean this you know the principle in management, you get what you measure,
Yeah.
and if we right now the mainstream discussion in context of clean energies, we have to get rid of fossil fuels, but and this is already some kind of like let's say technology, but what we want to get rid of is actually emission. So we and this is very popular to fix on something popular that we have to get rid of fossils without asking, okay, are they really, is that some kind of problem? This is the problem is emission. So if we would measure that we really have to get the emission out, then we open up new possibilities, for example, to convert energy from the same fossils in clean way. So this is what I often see that also in politics, it's we don't see cause and effect connections, and we jump between those causes and effects. And another kind of remark is it's kind of universal lessons. I see that this root cause analysis, or if we imagine that some problem is rooted in some very, let's say, deep level, and there is so many layers, and the higher we go with the cause effect, the more complicated it becomes to solve, and the solving itself will have a huge impact because it's wasted energy. So the deeper we can dig to solve the problem, the easier. We have actually in Nefenko so-called energy awareness initiative. We believe strongly that it's not only the technology that supposed to change really planet for good. This is also our behavioral. And actually, this your question about Paris. I'm really happy to. There was the highest level of participants from states. John Kerry and Ursula von der Leyen and other people, ministers, and the. What was said there that we need to, the term was mentioned, innovate also our people behavior, also politicians innovation and financial system innovation. So what we see from Mefenko with this energy awareness initiative that the technology itself doesn't solve everything. We have to change how we interact, what we as a people use, what is the kind of responsibility we everybody take when we make one or the other decision. So kind of balancing this technological mindset always that okay, how I and coming back to where I came, when we start to solve problems in the highest cause and effect layers, then the energy that we waste to solve this complexity is no, it is waste energy. So we have to dig in.
Yeah, I really like that perspective. I fully agree. I was at an event a few days back where someone was talking about circular economy, and she made the good example that, what do you need to put up a picture on the wall? And I guess most people would say, well, a drill or, some sort of nail and a hammer. But I guess what the real answer is, and a first step is, you don't need those tools. What you need is a hole, potentially. And I think that is exactly what you were describing around the emissions as well, right? What is it that we're looking at? What's the problem that we're trying to solve? It's not ultimate. I mean, it's also replacing fossil fuels, but ultimately it's reducing emissions. So how can we do this in the best, fastest, and most efficient ways? And just changing that perspective really, really helps, and helps to focus your energy, that is unfortunately not infinite, on the problems that really matter. Towards the end of our conversation, I'd like to ask you also, because we've been talking quite a bit about, well, the applications, how the tech works, and the challenges that you had to overcome so far. What's the plan for Ifenko in the next 3 to 5 years? So where do you want to go? What's going to happen?
Yeah, coming back to the earth from concepts and ideas. At the moment, we build and iterate this prototyping the technology, so it the durability will be enough to enter into the pilots. Mainly, as I said, in industrial combustion domain and enter to the market there. But in parallel, the electrolysis is also on the table for us next 3 to 5 years. One inside joke is that I've seen it many times in my journey that being in deep tech, giving really like strong statements about time is very, very challenging. And we don't we are in the journey where we see behind the next corner, but the next corner is unknown always. But our mindset is actually to have pilots in place during this year. So industrial pilots, those pilot customers are ready. We have already kind of waiting list, small waiting list that who are ready to pilot. Then of course to get all the fixes what is needed that comes out of the pilot. And our ambitious goal is to really earn great value and earn funds in next year, 2025. This is our goal. And like investor-wise or fundraising-wise, we are at the moment, we were lucky to get the European Innovation Council grant and equity coverage a year ago. Now we have, let's say, runway for 1 year, but we are already preparing next round, hopefully happening at the end of second half of this year, to accelerate the development, to add team, to add partnerships, to et cetera, et cetera. This is briefly our goal.
Nice. And following that, because obviously that you've been doing this for quite some time. What is it that keeps you going? If we use that concept of energy once more, where does the energy to get up every morning and focus both on the tiniest aspects, particles, plasma, but also then the biggest side of it, the story, the impact that you're going to have, reducing emissions. Where does that energy come from? What keeps you going?
It's kind of a funny question. In one hand, I don't I remember from my, let's say, this consultancy time that this was a kind of question that, okay, when I wake up, what is the motivation and what I but not, right now this is not on the table. I don't think about that. So it's yeah, I can say maybe it is as it is. When I started this journey, I felt that this is something what I have to do. Just the kind of realization that this is my journey, or you don't like pronounce those words, but this is the feeling that there is no questions or no motivation thing that I have to articulate to myself. It's just what I do, and I'm really like getting energy out of that. Also the challenges or what comes on the road. And I mean this it's not me. We have really, really great team, management team as well. The way we're working, this is it's just naturally so energizing that I mean, it's not always nice, but we have this truthfulness and principle that we talk everything, and this is kind of inspiring, that challenging and inspiring and energizing in the same time.
Yeah, and I guess that's really motivating in a sense, because the what you're doing is really important and really complex, and having the right team around you and the right sense that, yes, especially the startup journey is not always easy, but having assembled a team where you can tackle those challenges together and thereby really making an impact, that does make a difference.
Absolutely agree.
Well, Christian, thank you so much for that deep dive today. I certainly learned a lot today, and I'm very happy that I could refresh all my physics knowledge. Best of luck with your journey, Fenka's journey, and looking forward to seeing you scale and seeing you thrive.
Thank you very much, Jim.